Welcome back to episode 33 of Talking Physiotherapy Podcast. This week, I'm delighted to introduce Andrew McCauley, who's going to be joining myself and Frank for this week's episode. So, Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
How's it going, lads?
Very good.
Super excited, eh?
I can
hear it, you know, and see it in your faces. You seem very excited by this.
Pausing.
Before we begin, I would like to give a quick shout out to our sponsors at Neonic Training Solutions. Neonic is based in Shipley, West Yorkshire, and operates as a student-led physiotherapy clinic. Neonic provides placement opportunities for a range of healthcare students and not just physios. Offering independent but supported patient contact coupled with excellent learning opportunities, their range of placements are designed to elevate your proficiency in clinical practice and foster confidence in your professional journey. This is a fantastic placement opportunity for all healthcare students. If you're intrigued, reach out to your university's placement lead as Neonic collaborate with universities nationwide. Or if you're considering an elective, you can always go direct.
Yeah, so Andrew, do you want to tell us a little bit more about sort of your backstory and a little bit more about you?
Yeah, sure. I'll keep it fairly brief. So the backstory really, I never keep things brief. I'd say that and I'm just going to rant. So. I suppose the interesting one, I suppose I come from a family of eight people, which is probably one of the main drivers for being a physio when I really reflect on it. And that's because when you're eight, you know, 10 people around the table, you kind of have to, you have to communicate in a certain way and you have to communicate in different ways. And yeah, I was the youngest. So there's a way of learning how to communicate with these people who are older, funnier, have more things to say. So I guess I come from a family in the west of Ireland that's pretty big. And then from there, I kind of, it's a bit of a paradox when it comes to my backstory because I hated school. I liked school from my mates and playing football, and sport was good, but I didn't like the academic side of school at all. Didn't suit me. I've said that many times on previous podcasts, but the more and more I think of it, it was that, yeah, I just didn't want to be in the school. Thought the education system was pretty crap. Still think it is to a certain degree. And then I just needed to get out of Ireland because, yeah, I just wanted to explore a little bit. Went to the UK, did sports science, like anyone who can't get the points for physio in Ireland because I wasn't smart enough or stayed in school long enough. So I did that, sports science. And then I suppose the key thing from that was coaching was emphasized a lot, which I always used to think, oh, it was the exercise physiology and the sports science back, and then the scientific writing. But I think looking back, I did a lot of coaching there, which helped. And then I really kind of, from that, I was like, I've always wanted to be a physio. I can't really explain why. I think just had an interest in health and stuff. But it comes back to when I reflect on it, I think communication was a big part of it. I like talking shit to people. I like meeting people. I like people's stories, but I'm a bit nosy like that. I think that's where my career has gone and why I ended up. So I always thought, oh, it's sport. It's because I like sport and because I got injured and I met a physio, blah, blah, blah. But actually, it's not. I just like talking to people all day long, which is what we do. And interestingly, again, during physio, which your listeners, because I know your kind of demographic could be like the students and maybe new grads as well. I really didn't like the physio degree. I like the idea. Don't get me wrong, the lectures I actually all right. The university was fine. There was nothing different than any other physio degree. It was actually, in fact, really well supported. So I'm not slagging that off. I just hated placements. Like I hated school. I think I might have said to you before. And looking back now, I think it's when I see students now, I've always tried to reduce their anxiety as much as possible because they were just awful. And you were kind of, I don't know what it was, but the vibe with other student physios was all about like marks. And I remember just being obsessed with marks myself. And now I see physios coming and our students coming and they're obsessed with the marks. And it just does not help the learning environment on practical placement. I get a university needs to have marks for certain stuff. That's part of it. But when on placement, it needs to be pass or fail. And it needs to be just getting those physios to just relax in a very stressful environment because your patients are stressed. And so physio students are stressed. The supervisor of the students is stressed. It's a real ball of anxiety, which affects communication both ways. So I'm sure lots of physios I talk to always say, oh, that I had a placement, it was awful. I hated my tutor, didn't like this, I didn't like that. And I wonder, is it a mixture because of this pressure to that you're put under, especially in for me MSK placements, because there's so much and you've only got like 5 weeks. That was really stood out as very difficult, even though it was the area I wanted to be good at, which then you'd put more pressure on yourself and think you were more crap because you couldn't do it. And then from there, I went to London, and then I went to move to Cornwall because my wife's from there. Did a master's in sports medicine. And this is the paradox, is I enjoyed the master's more than any other education I did, which is the hardest, you know, effectively the hardest type thing, or, you know, the one that you look into more depth. And that's because I had about 6 or 7 years, maybe even longer experience. Yeah, about 8 years experience. And I was applying everything I was learning. So I was hungry for it. And I was kind of, and the marks actually, that was the one time I was like, I don't care about the marks. I just want to get the information and use it. So as soon as I switched that kind of mindset, I did way better. I got the best marks I've got in all the degrees I did, which is bizarre. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, you know, from there, then again, I never set out to do a mat. You know, when I was, you know, again, which might be useful for a backstory, is I never set out like, oh, I'm going to be this physio or I'm going to do that. I definitely wanted MSK. And looking back again, every time I try and do an interview like this, I'm always like, is it really what I was thinking? And when I got into it, I thought sport might be something, but quite quickly, sport is a different kettle of fish, like you probably know. And I knew I wanted my weekends, and I wanted to go raving in Berlin at the weekends or whatever I wanted to do. I didn't want to have to be relying on a private in joke there for the listeners. I didn't want to have to, you know, give up my weekends. Do you know what I mean? So I knew sport wasn't going to be the big one. But then I had to have always, you've always, my main thing was that I always wanted to be moving forward. I kind of just like, if I was a bit comfortable, I felt like, oh, I need to do something challenging. And then, you know, out of that came a private practice, which now I work in the NHS half the week, which is in hips, knees and shoulders. Specialist, but I also do rehab as well. And then I do 2.5 days in private practice and I teach a 2-day course as well called Unraveling Strength and Conditioning. That's the longest intro you've ever had. I can
definitely is. I know you said you like talking, so
yeah, there you go.
So Andrew, can I just ask, so you said you came from a big family of 8 people. Could you delve a wee bit into how that help with, I know you talk a lot about communication and the importance of it with physiotherapy or coaching or any discipline really. Could you just maybe delve into that there and how the brothers and sisters kind of help shape you with regards to the physiotherapy?
Yeah, because my next brother up is 5 years, and so he's the nearest one to me, and then it goes all the way. So I'm 43, my oldest, my sister is 61. So I guess it shapes you, and I'm looking back, it's like, I was exposed to like, my brothers were in, it's like the music side of things, or, you know, your older brothers, like I was listening to music that none of my mates would have been unless they had older brothers. So I was listening to Joy Division, New Order, Stone Roses, all that kind of stuff, The Clash. So I was influenced by their music. And then in order to kind of hang out with them, so that's the kind of thing, you'd listen to that music and then their friends would be over. And I would sit there and listen to the conversations. And you kind of be, and then they'd come around to for dinner or whatever, and you sit around and you have mates. So you're always exposed to kind of like, I suppose, a mature conversation. I am definitely not mature, but at the time you're just hearing this stuff. And actually, what was a big part of it was comedy as well. So they'd listen to, back in the day, like there was things like The Fast Show and Harry Enfield, these kind of guys, Steve Coogan, and we used to like. You know, again, a lot of my mates were like, I don't know who any of those people are, because they didn't have older brothers necessarily. So I'd be hearing all this, and then I'd be taking them, you know, I'd be trying to mimic the characters to make my brothers laugh. So it was always kind of like, I suppose you're exposed to a lot of, whereas if you were only 2 or 3 and your brother next to you was 2 years older, you wouldn't get that. So I'm really lucky that it's even when it comes to friends as well, I'm quite lucky because like, all my best mates are in my family, you know. So, you know, some people don't get on with their brothers and sisters. I do. So I'm kind of lucky from that point of view. And I suppose that builds confidence as well, because you've always got an army of people behind you who you really trust. And I think trust is a big part of communication. So I guess I've always been quite confident with it. And I think I've been confident in a lot of things. Doesn't mean I walk around like, you know, arrogant, but I'm generally quite confident when speaking, and I think that comes from that. Don't know if that answers your question, Frank.
That was good. It's just because I've heard of other people say the public speaking and all, but just because you came from like a bigger family, I can kind of see that. Especially, I know in my class, if I look at some of my friends who are really good, I know they play hockey or sports, and because they're in a, they have a variety or a range of ages in the team, they can generally talk. I think that's a huge skill in this profession, or even that I can see with students, just the ability to talk to older people, younger people. But it was just I never even thought about it like that.
You just made me think of something which is a bit random. I haven't thought of it this way, but we played loads of sports, and my dad was into Gaelic football mainly, but golf, he wanted us all to be able to play golf. So we were lucky enough to have clubs and stuff. And we lived beside a golf course. So you'd go over, and even in the golf, if you've ever been in a golf club, is it definitely an etiquette, and there's definitely kind of that, you know. And I remember it used to be like, I used to slag all the real, like, because I go over and knock about the odd time. I wasn't definitely one of those ones who had chinos and, you know, all the gear and, you know, walk around with a polo shirt on. But all the lads that were my age, they were like the golfer heads. They all dressed like, you know, they were about 70. But they used to talk in a certain way as well. Like, they would, because they were always playing golf with men, like in their 40s or 50s. So these lads were chatting to me, and I'm like, oh, what plan are you on? He was chatting to me like, you know, it was just bizarre. But I was like, well, they're constantly surrounded by men, you know, who talk in a certain way and talk about sport in a certain way. And you, so you're definitely influenced by that. And I think that's, that's the beauty about communication. We'll probably dive into that a little bit more, is that it's one of those skills that we're constantly able to change and adapt and get better at more than anything else in our profession. Like, if we're a therapist, it's the one skill you can constantly, you don't have to go on a course necessarily, because you can actually reflect on how well the conversations went. You don't actually need to go on loads of courses to start with. You can just be like, how did that go from a personality to personality type connection? Why didn't that work? Rather than just like, oh, I didn't get the diagnosis, or I didn't do the right exercise, or whatever. It's usually like, actually, you didn't connect there, and mm-hmm. something affected your connection. What was that? And that's quite tricky, and that's taken me. That's where I think the profession is going. And if we can get better at that, and that there's so much to explore in that, I think we'll unleash a far better therapy for our patients as well.
Yeah, I mean, we can dive into communication a little bit more now, Andrew. I've heard you speak quite a lot about communication and like the actual facets to communication. I think you said on a different podcast that you delivered a talk and you asked everybody in the crowd who had actually done further communication training, and it was next to nobody when you looked at the cohort of people that were there, and that kind of triggered the people think they're better at communication than they actually are. And I think we can reflect on that. Everyone's, they're talking about good communication when you're coming out of university, but how much communication practice have we actually done, apart from just being thrown into the situation? So what are sort of some things that you've picked up along the way that maybe the listeners, new grad students, can start of thinking about or reflecting on and trying to build into the way they speak to their colleagues, the other students, their patients? How can people improve on that in those areas?
Yeah. Oh God, I need to wind myself in here. I could go and go. I think the thing about it, one of the things that I'm always, I might start with this, is like, every patient interaction you have is a story of two anxious people. And I think you've heard me say this in my talk before, where I'm like, the patient's anxious and you're anxious as a therapist. And what I mean is, when I say anxious, people are like, well, I'm not anxious. And you're like, going, well, it's not anxious as in you're worried necessarily, but you want to try and solve a problem for a patient. That's your job. And that's kind of can be like, what happens if I can't solve that problem? And I think when you start as a new grad or student, you're like, I have no idea what I'm doing about it. You know, I'm speaking from my own side. I would have been like, how's this going to go? And like, I remember my first two or three years, I was wrecked at the end of the day, absolutely wrecked. And then I'd have to go home and try and read up and try and, you know, even look at what patients I was seeing next to, because I had no I had no frameworks to look at, and it was just draining me. Like, and it was just, you would turn up, and you, this idea that I had to solve people's problems and that I'd have to get through the assessment as quick as I possibly could, and then make sure I did stuff to them or did stuff for them, and did all this. That's what a physio was supposed to be, that I'd have to do all these things. And I wish someone had said to me, like, you know, just chill the fuck out with you. And actually, a lot of what patients want is just to be listened to. And I know everyone says that, and they do, but really listen to them. Because, again, I had a patient today who came in, and again, we did an hour with her, and she'd seen physios in the past. She's had osteotomies, leg length discrepancy, seen surgeons, been sent to me. And the whole conversation was having to let her explain to her what has worked, what's not worked. And really all we had to do was I had to focus in on what she really enjoyed doing. And what she actually enjoyed doing was her husband's kickbox instructor. And she liked hitting the pads before, but she was too worried that she'd make things worse. The other thing, she liked swimming. But when she said that, she went, but when she had her trauma, which was a road traffic accident 20 years previous, the scars on her leg put her off going to the swimming. And she was in tears, and all this stuff started coming out just by asking her what she wanted to get back doing. Like, what was she really wanting? Not a bridge exercise that she's been given 50 times, or a specific, not that there's anything wrong with that, but she'd been given very mechanical stuff. Do this and you will get better. And she said, well, it'll get better for a bit, and then the next day it would be back again. And I've done that for years. So I was like, well, you're telling me already that things aren't working. So the best thing is to listen and go, can I find out what you really wanted? And from just asking that question, I got a huge amount of grief and trauma that she was bringing up, her, you know, fear about around her body, etc. And that's all we talked about for an hour. And at the end, she just went, you're the only person, you're the first person who's ever listened to me and not made me feel like I'm a, she actually went, I'm not like any cattle mart. And I just started laughing. She says, before it used to be like in, and she used to live beside a cattle mart where she used to hear the animals go in, noise, 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 quiet, and then noise, noise, noise again. This is what she said to me. And she says, that's what I think physio is. You come in, do loads of stuff, and then just leave. And nothing happens. It's silence. There's no help. That's how she described her previous episodes of physio, which I was like, such an, you know, a mental thing. And I know your question is, what do I advise physios to do to start with, is just start to listen to really what people want, you know, not just, oh, I want to be out of pain, because everyone wants to be out of pain. It's a bit like, what do you want to get back to that makes you happy and gives you meaning? If you start with that, you can build rehab programs from that. And the thing about it is, you just have to stop panicking. And I think it's difficult. So I appreciate, like, I try to do it with anyone I do supervision with, is like, just there's no rush here. No one's going to give out to you if you haven't done every single assessment or every single physical assessment. And if you kind of just spend some time listening at the start, you can always get through something. And patients, especially in the NHS, but you know, where you've got a little bit of leeway. It's difficult when you're in private practice and they're paying you money. That is difficult. That is in some ways harder, because you're having to kind of be nearly forced to do things to them, because you're afraid that you haven't given them their money's worth. And it definitely took me a while, and I could nearly practice this type of thinking in the NHS, because there was no risk of someone turning around going, well, you know, I've just paid you 50 quid and you've just listened to me. And so I put it into practice, and then realized that actually in private practice, I do the same thing and no one gives out, because I usually I'm able to target exactly what they want. So the things that I would advise is definitely try and get someone who can mentor you from that side of the, from that approach. I think you should read a lot around psychology. That would be my, there's plenty of books. I can send you boys a reference list and you can chuck it wherever you chuck it. And I'm going to name a couple of books maybe throughout this as well. That's worth doing. But I would read not just physiotherapy, you know, physical assessments, that's great and everything, but I would definitely read more around habit formation, behavior change, communication. You can get books on that, and I would start doing that now. And then as soon, I'd say within maybe a couple of years, if not sooner, get some sort of formal communication training. There's health coaching, there's motivational interviewing. I don't think there's any need to kind of wait too long, but just give yourself maybe 6 months just to kind of bed in. And then I think I would nearly do that before I would do any other course. And I know people are busting to find out about the knee, but I tell you what, not an awful lot changes with the joints. You do one course and then you'll do another one, and the way it's delivered will be different. And I've done loads of shoulder courses, for instance, and I've taken stuff from each one of those courses. But there comes a point where after a while, like the research just changes a little bit. Whereas with communication, it's huge. It just keeps going because every single patient that's in front of you has a different personality and has a different experience. So how do you figure out these people? Well, the only way you can do is by developing your questioning, developing your listening skills, knowing when to interrupt, when to lead in, when to use emotional intelligence. Again, second longest answer you've probably ever had, but yeah, that's what I would say.
No, that was refreshing to hear that, Andrew, because I know in my placement, I went from one placement in private MSK with a really good physio back home, Daggy, in Lurgan, and his subjective took his time. If it took the full hour, took the full hour. And then I left that on the Friday, and on the Monday I was on that new placement over in England. I was in a hospital setting, and subjective, like, it wasn't 10 minutes, not even 12 minutes, I would say. And I got, marked down for subjective too long on, that CPAP framework thing, the paperwork at the end. I remember I was saying to the educators at school, surely I can't get marked down for subjective being too long. And they were like, no, I lost marks for the subjective being too long. But I think that's key. And just from what you're saying there, especially that lady that came in with the swimming and the kickboxing, you get all that information. And she's leaving your practice there today thinking he's the first person to really listen to me in a long time, not feeling like a cattle mark. I don't know how hospital settings can be so quick, and then when you're going to private, because I know you do a bit of both, do you find there's a big difference between your workplace for the subjective?
So there's a couple of things there. That was in my NHS day today, just to point out. But it doesn't matter. It would have mattered, if it was in private practice. I do the same approach. It's no different. It was interesting. Remember I said at the beginning, you said, like, I don't think physio students should be get a mark. They should be safe or not safe, and then they should be guided towards it. Exactly like you said there, you got marked down. So you're already having a negative experience, all about the marks instead of actually, it's a focus, because so basically the supervisor has to go, right, here's my list. Oh, what did they do? They're under pressure to make sure that they've done all their tick boxing and marked you. And then you don't come back at them with something. And therefore they're like, oh, well, he spent too long doing that. But I'm like going, who did I see recently? And I was chatting to as well. When I had students, I don't get students as much now, really, for years now. But when I did, I was always like, spend the first 2 weeks. I don't care if you assess a shoulder physically. This was my approach. My whole thing was, can I calm their anxiety down, make them just relax, just ask questions. Don't worry if you come out and you haven't a clue what's going on. You're not going to have a clue. But at least if you ask about night pain, find out why you're asking about that. If you're going to ask about what they want to do, tell me why you asked that question. I don't care. You're going to don't spend tonight looking up assessment tests for a shoulder. I don't care. I'll help you with that bit. If we go in together, we'll go through a shoulder assessment. It's not what it's about. I want you going in there talking to people about their health. That's hard enough as it is. And you need to be not worried about what I'm going to say when you come out. So that, I know we can't solve physiotherapy's problem with their marking system, but that I'm really strongly believe that that needs to change. And from my your kind of question about, does that matter in private practice or, in the NHS? No. And when I set up my private practice, I don't think that everyone should do this, but my new patient appointments are an hour and a half. They're 90 minutes. Now, sometimes I do 60 minutes, depending when I speak to the person on the phone, if they say, oh, I've got this condition, or if I've seen them before, or something like that. And if I've seen them before, I've hopefully built a connection and trust. And that's what I'm trying to do in that initial stage. That is my sole goal. Because if you do not build that, you can be Mr. Exercise Program Specialist dude with all your letters at the end, but they will not do it, or they will do very little of it. And the research is clear on that as well. So there's plenty of stuff. So on my course, I talk about the evidence around adherence and commitment. And most people do not commit longer than 6 weeks or struggle with any more than one or two exercises. But yet you're taught to be like, right, you got to do all these things and then give them a sheet of things so that you look like you know what you're talking about. Give yourself a good pat on the shoulder and then that patient goes away happy. And that's not the reality.
Yeah, I think you've covered quite a lot of things there, Andrew. I think one of the things that I'm quite key on is about sort of what that patient goes away from your appointment with, and that point about trying to get everything in, the pressure that the therapist is feeling, the pressure that the patient's feeling because they're getting rushed, they're not having chance to speak, the anxiety on both parts. But I think what kind of comes from that psychology side of it is you go away thinking about how that thing made you feel. You're not going to remember everything the physio said to you, but you're definitely going to remember how you felt in that appointment. And I think if someone's rushing through all that with you, not really listening to you, you're going to go through and be like, whoa, that was a lot. Kind of felt like we had to do everything. I didn't really listen to the important things that they said. I've forgotten what exercise was already. It's not a valuable use of either person's time, really. And I think sort of that bringing it back to just focus on this, reduce the anxiety, make the patient feel more comfortable. You get a lot more out of it when you think about, I think, is the statistic patients remember 11% of what happens?
So there was one done in 19, a study done in 1965 where they looked at people who'd just seen a doctor and they forgot 55% of what was said.
And that's immediately afterwards.
Immediately, so, literally, what did you... You know, so yeah, like it's the other reason why and health literacy as well. So there's this public study, health study done in 2018 in the Birmingham area. I think it was England or Public Health England or whatever, looked at health literacy. And it wasn't just because it's Birmingham. So it just happened to be this. They reckon this is across the board. It's not just that area. Is that it was as people's understanding of health is 42% of people struggled with understanding any kind of health information. And if you add writing to that or numeracy, it goes up to 62%. So if you give people like leaflets or sheets with information, it actually can make it worse because they can't read or they struggle to read what's in that paper. So anything you start talking about, what arthritis is or any of that stuff, you just take it for a lot of people will struggle with that. And most people do not like to be made feel stupid. So they will nod and give you all the social norms of, yeah, that makes, yeah, 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 and all that kind of, and they'll come back with something totally different or they may not come back again. And that's the other thing, because if they don't want to feel stupid or they'll make reasons for it. So I will always video people now for years now, where I will video not only the exercises but also everything I said, a summary of what I said. It's not for everyone, and I can understand maybe if you were asking me to do that in my first couple of years of qualified or whatever, I would have been like, Christ, I'm bluffing my arse off here, which is what I was doing, to be honest. But what I would do now is just I think the quality of therapists is definitely improving. I can just see even the likes of you lads now even having this conversation and doing all this. This is miles ahead of what I was doing. So it's great. But I think what I do is to say, well, look, what do I want to say out loud to this patient and any of the information I can so that they can go home when they're a little bit less surrounded by me, you know, and they can look at this video and they can show their partner and actually go through and say, all right, this is what he said. So I think that's a really useful tool. It's not for everyone, but it's something that I find patients come back and go, thank God you did that video because, I went home and I had to watch it again, do you know?
Yeah, I think that repetitive, and it links into the adherence as well, which is something that I want to go into. I can't remember if at the NCORE conference it was you or if it was Mike James who talked about asking patients how much time they can give to sort of your treatment or how much time they have available for you on their worst day.
Me and Mike are very similar, so it's kind of like I'm going, I think it was Mike who would have specifically mentioned that. But yeah, no, I think, yeah. So Mike James is great as well. And we both sing out of the same hymn sheet when it comes to that. And I think when it comes to that time, because again, most people over-exaggerate how much time they have. I call it the Italian lie. And the Italian thing, I'd have to explain a different time. But the Italian lie is basically, most people will say, I'll do whatever it takes. You know, you tell me now, because they're in pain. They're like, all right, you just tell me what I need to do and I'll do it, right? And then sounds great. You're saying, oh, excellent, right, here's all these exercises. Go and do that and then come back to me. Unfortunately, people will say stuff like that when they're in lots and lots of pain. So the first thing, one thing I'll do is like going, well, let's look at your week Monday to Sunday, first of all. What time do you get up? What responsibilities have you got when you get up? You got kids? Have you got to go to work? What time do you got to go work at? And how long is it going to take you to get there? What's the environment like? What are you going to have to do when you get there? What's your lunch look like? When do you eat? What time do you get in at? What do you have? What responsibilities do you have when you get in? What time do you go to bed? You know, all of that. And when you just lay it all out like that, and it sounds like a lot, it doesn't take that long. Most people are fairly, you know, and then they look at it and they go, okay, I don't have very much time at all. And that's when you need to kind of hone in, going, okay, that's all right. So where are we going to do this thing? And that's where when you get coaching training, you can start to kind of get patients to solve their own problems. But you have to highlight to them. You can't just assume, because I remember I used to just throw exercise sheets at people as they left the door and hope that they would do these things, which is, you know, and I've done that. So it's not like I'm here sitting on a big, I've had to learn the hard way. But you have to point out to patients that you are here. This is your reality down here. And you're saying you want to be here, which is whatever that is, whatever that goal is that you've decided. And we need to get from here to here. How are we going to do that? And if it requires us to do this amount of exercise, then you need this amount of time and this amount of commitment. But there's no point in saying that if we don't have that. So how are we going to do it? And they it encourages them to kind of go, right, well, I could probably do this amount or I could probably do this. You're like going, okay, well, probably are you going to? And then we can kind of go, okay, let's commit to that. And then let them, and that's why I use whiteboards as well. And I'm kind of pointing like a lunatic here for people who are listening without a screen. But basically you've got a whiteboard with all these things so that the patient can sit there and kind of look at you and look at their lives kind of as a separate person. Nearly like they've put their life on there, and it helps them kind of just nearly be a little bit more logical and less emotional, because they can be a bit like, oh yeah, right, I can see the problem here, I can see what's going on. And then they put the pieces together, and together we share decision making, if you want to use that buzzword, in where we're going to get with. So I'm not telling them what to do, I'm just saying, what are we going to do here? Here's some suggestions. Where are these going to go in? Where are they going to slot into your time frame?
Does
that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. It's just so personal, personable. Yeah, you're finding out about them for them to feel better, to get your timings. You're really laying it out so they can be analytical about it. And at the end of the day, you're putting the power in the patient's hands. And someone's more likely to do something if they felt like they sort of came to that conclusion as well, rather than, well, this is what I've been told to do to get better. And you're just going to feel like they've got a real plan. Of like where to go. So yeah, I really, really think that's valuable.
If anyone, have you guys ever been coached by somebody? Like, you know, like that in a way, like, you
just as a question to you guys. Stuff, yeah.
No, just even like coach towards like you want to get somewhere or you want to do something, I don't know, like just to kind of like, or even, yeah, you've got a goal and someone's going to help you get there. Like even, like I had a, you know, strength and conditioning coach, you then was like, well, what do you want to get out of this? And I had to give them a go, and then they worked it out for me. But have you ever been coached like that, where, because it's, if you haven't, it's absolutely on, that's why doing coaching courses helped me out, because on the courses you have to kind of, you kind of, I think I did one a couple of years ago, and it was they said, oh, think of something you really want so that the person can coach you, not just like, don't make it up. So I was like, oh, I want to go to bed earlier. I'm awful for going to bed. And so we got stuck into it. And I was like, fucking hell, this is quality, this. By the end of it, I was like going, what am I doing? You know what I mean? She used all the skills that we got from the course, and she was laughing away, and I'm laughing at going, this is really, why haven't I done this before? And then same thing happened for her. We did it. And we started noticing the kind of mistakes. She was like going, you want to tell me something? And I was like, yeah, I'm busting to tell you something, but I know I have to leave the silence. And she could even read from my body language that I wanted her to do something in my head. That's what she said to me. She was like, you want to tell me something? And I just started laughing. And I was literally going, yeah, I want to fix this problem for you right now. And what happened is I didn't say anything. And then she figures it out by herself. And that's way more powerful. And I went, that's the fucking thing I was going to say. And she's like, well, I knew you were going to say, I knew you were thinking something. I said, instead of that, we've got some sort of telepathy. And I've just told you what to do through telepathy. And we've discovered this. And we need to market it and make loads of money. Or it's just that I didn't say anything and she's figured it out through questions that I've asked her or whatever. So it's an unbelievably powerful tool. And I know people will be skeptical of communication in a way of thinking, you know, you go into profession and it is trained to be like problem solves. We are detectives, right? Here, ask these questions, find out about symptoms, and then you spit it out the other side. But we've moved so far on from that. And we are different orthopedic surgeons. They have a different treatment technique than we have. We have to continue, like, our treatment technique does not knock them out and then they wake up and then that technique is over. Our technique goes on and people will have ups and downs, emotional changes, financial implications, changes in jobs. They'll be told that they may have to lose their job. You know, one day is this, one day is that. Like, our treatment goes on and on and on, and we have to completely be adaptable or flexible to every single mood that they come into. You know, I'm not comparing us to surgeons because they have a different thing. It's like, all right, I've got this thing to do. Go to sleep, wake up. The surgery's either worked or it doesn't, now you go away. We don't have that. We don't have to be psychologists. We have to be coaches. And there's a big difference between a psychologist and a coach implementing psychological interventions. Because psychological interventions are goal setting, visualization, planning, Socratic interviewing, motivational interviewing. These are all techniques that are, a psychologist will look back into the past and work on things that have happened. We don't have to do that. We need to actually just set a goal or a want and then go from where you are right now and help them achieve that.
Yeah, perfect. I think there's a lot to say for how we approach. You've always got a lot to say, but yeah, for how we can approach it and the different techniques that we can input. And some of it is a lot more simple than we try and make it out, and we can make it more difficult for ourselves if we try and cram all these different things in. But if you kind of bring it to your values, find a way that you want to sort of run that subjective and get to know your patients, how do you want to be as a physio, kind of the similar stuff that Dalton was saying on the last podcast about finding out who you want to be as a physio and then just applying that to each patient you see. If you can get this sort of base understanding, you can build on those skills and build those relationships with the patients rather than just trying to get sort of into the objective side of it and the actual treatment. I think that can definitely come afterwards.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, no, absolutely. I like what he was saying there as well. I listened to him before I came into to you guys today. I wanted to just say a little story, tell you a little story about kind of how what I'm trying to say when it comes to you and what he was saying as well, as you as a person and how it affects patients, right? So this is something I've shared more and more. I used to do it a lot every so often on my course, and now I make it an absolute mainstay because of the reaction it gets. And that story is basically and it can get interpreted as like someone needs to put an arm around me, but it really isn't. So it starts off pretty dark and then it ends up good. So most mornings, and I would say especially before work, I work 6 days a week, so I work a lot, and it can be hard. I've got young kids, which can affect things from the point of view of, like, you know, just they can be sick or whatever, you know, stress, etc. So I wake up most mornings, but I've always done that. It's never been a morning person. I wake up pretty a bit like not great, just not in a great mood, just feel internally a little bit crap, to be honest. And I don't need violins or anything like that. It's quite normal for a lot of people who've come up to me after hearing the story. Cortisol levels are high in the morning, wakes you up, but it also can be quite difficult. So I'll be in my first steps are I'm in the shower and I have to get to the shower. So I'm always like, right, just this happens every day. So I have to have self-talk. And I think learning the psychology of things like this chimp paradox model and other things like that, understand that, you know, at different times your mindset will be playing tricks with you. And my Achilles heel is in the morning before work. And I try to reflect back on why this happened. So I get in the shower and I'm always like, you know what? I don't know. I wonder who my first patient is. And I kind of hope it's the same feeling I used to get before sport. I used to play football quite a lot, at reasonably all right level. And I'd been super nervous beforehand until I got on the pitch. And then I'd be fine. But beforehand, it was awful. And I feel like that in the shower is a bit like, oh, what happens if I don't, what if I get found out today? Or maybe I don't solve the problem. And this is, you know, physios, I'm 20 years qualified now. And you might be thinking, Christ, if he's 20 years qualified, he's still feeling like this. It's different to what I felt when I was first qualified. I wasn't the same. I would feel different anxiety then. And what happened was I'd feel like in the shower and then I'd be like, no, just get to your coffee. So I do these little steps in my head. It's like, just get to the coffee. It's going to go away. It's going to go away. Make the coffee. And then during the coffee, as I'm waiting for that to brew it, I get on my phone and I'm like, I need to select a podcast or a book that I'm going to listen to in the car journey. So this is just occupying my mind while I'm a little bit, you know, anxious, if you want to call it that. And then I have to decide on music, football podcast, or something I'm going to learn it from. Now, interesting, if I go to the learning thing, what I realize is that sometimes I love to make notes on podcasts, or I like to make notes on the book. Otherwise, I'm going to forget it and you're not going to implement it, or I want to use it in my course or something like that. So I can get a bit stressed because I have to pull over, do a voice note, pull out again, and it ends up adding another 15 minutes to my car journey. So there's a barrier there sometimes that even when I'm trying to get better as a therapist and learn, I'm like, oh, I could just put the football on and then I wouldn't have to do that. But then I wouldn't get to the clinic with extra learning in. So I'm having to make that choice and I'm like, right, put that podcast on. And then I'll get to the local town, which is about 15 minutes away. By the time, if I don't want to continue listening to this or it's annoying me, I'll turn it off. So there's a point to all this. So I get in the car. The podcast goes on, I start listening, and 9 times out of 10, I'm like, I'm really into it. And I'm starting to go, I'm glad I'm listening to this, and it makes me feel good. So I carry on listening until I get to work. But sometimes because of whatever, kids, traffic stuff, might get to work a bit late, so you just get in on time. Patient's already waiting, computer doesn't boot up quick, can't get my car to work, I'm now 5-10 minutes late. Just before I left, my missus goes, do you remember that thing you have to do after work? Oh, shit. Yeah, right. Now I'm going to be, I've got stuff to do after work, or my kids doing something that's annoying me or something like that. And I'm now 10 minutes late, I'm in work and I'm stressed. Now, do you think, if you're listening, or you two lads now, I'm going to be affected in that first patient's interaction with my communication? Well, from my point of view, is because of the stress, you know, so I kind of tricked you there because I was kind of playing around with how I manage myself through that morning until I get to the car and then I'm kind of fine. But then I end up 10 minutes late. I'm now going, right, I'm 10 minutes late. I've got this stressful thing to do after work and a patient comes in, right? And I forgot to add this bit, actually. This is the bit of the story that the patient stands up when you call their name and they don't say hello. They sigh, walk past you, sit on the chair and sigh again. That was the bit I forgot to mention actually in the story. And that's when I said, does my psychology change about all the stuff I just had to go through? I'm 10 minutes late. This patient does not look like they want to be there or there's going to be something on. So how am I going to now change my mindset so I can listen and do all those things I was saying earlier on with this patient right now? How am I going to get them connected to me, build that trust. And I think more and more, the more I can get into a mindset of, right, there's not much I can do about being 10 minutes late. There's not much I could just leave earlier the next time. There's not much I can do about the thing after work. There's not much I can do about the argument I had with my wee fella before I left. I have to now invest all my time now and all my concentration into this patient so that I do the best job for them. And I think that's the biggest skill I've learned over the last few years, where I've like managed to kind of nearly do a kind of a form of mindfulness where I'm now using the patient to solve their problem as a way of managing my own mental health, which is kind of a superpower in a way, because I kind of finished the patient feeling good, they feel good, and I've forgotten about the problem that I had before, or that feeling I had when I was in the shower when I was going, oh, am I going to solve this problem today? And I think that people will, if you can do that, some patients are going to be tricky, and you just have to have that word with yourself beforehand. In an hour's time, if I do the best job, I'll feel much better. Anyway.
There's a lot of value in that, and I think there's definitely two ways you can look at it, and it's based in your mindset. Like you said, you're trying to get yourself into that mindset where you can, I'm at work, I feel good if I do a good job, let's go do a good job. And you're switching that on rather than going, God, the patient doesn't want to be here, I don't want to be here, I've got a million other things to do, and they're just kind of sighing away. They could have had a terrible morning as well. But as a therapist, it's your job to turn around, put the empathetic face on, get in game mode and go do your job well. That's
Go on, Frank.
Take it long to master that, because like that does, like I'll say, I'm a student, geez, I have so much to learn. Like, but I'm listening to you say that, and I'm like, geez, that sounds good. But how long did that take for you to master that?
Because you know what I was saying, I was thinking, you know, what would be a value now? Because someone listening to you, rather than just going, you know, everything. Yeah, exactly. It's a continuous development. Like, this is the thing now, you see, you're at a, I'm not saying you're at an advantage, but like from the word go, it's hard, right? But it's all hard. But if you can start to learn your communication earlier and learn that you do get hijacked by your mindset now, you will be unbelievably more ahead of where I am, you know. And I've been doing it 20 years. My point is that, you know, right now you're like even listening to this conversation and thinking, right, I need to start thinking about this. I never got any of that information. This was before, it was just learn your joints, learn your anatomy, learn your physiology and your pathology. Basically, patients come in, you solve the problems, and then you move on. That was kind of how it was. Cattle march, like she said, because it just hit home. So even just you now, not, I don't want to add anxiety to people going, it's going to take me 20 years to realize this. I'm just saying, if you just self-reflect on your communication and how, like, you're thinking, I'm coming to work and I feel a bit shit. I feel a bit stressed out. Why do I feel like that? What can I do? But I'm going to my body language, my tone of voice, everything was going to be affected. And I can hear myself with patients sometimes, you know, when patients annoy me, they're triggering me to, and I have to kind of go, hang on, whoa, whoa, whoa. So it's just a constant self-reflection, just like if you're in a pub with somebody and you're having a conversation that you've maybe met somebody for the first time, and you can see maybe a conversation going, you have to steer it a little bit. You don't want it to be socially uncomfortable. So sometimes it's just being conscious of within a patient session, just to go, hang on a second, let's just check myself. I'm pushing my stuff onto somebody who's come to for help. And if I can't get that done, if I can't reflect on that now and know how that's going to affect my questioning of a patient or a treatment of a patient, you're going to lose patients. And basically, most physios who I work with who come to me for supervision, like I had one today with a band 7 FCP, and we had an hour's chat back and forth on this topic, and actually going, we don't do this. Everyone does reflection pieces on that patient, you know, who had the missed fracture or the missed AVN or this thing. And, you know, and I did this case study and on reflection, I missed this. And next time I would do this. And it's all great. And that's useful. But it's always like really rare stuff or really kind of like, oh, look at the end, you did a really good job. Reflections should be, this patient was an absolute pain in the ass. I didn't like them very much. I was 6 months into my 10th session. I hadn't a clue what it was going on about. They just kept banging on about a scan. I had no idea what I was doing. I just kept throwing exercises at them. And it was a communication problem from the very beginning. I did not build, you know, and I didn't know what to do. And I brought them to somebody, and then they asked better questions and listened. And now I have learned something. That's how, you know, reflection should look like that. But it will never look like that, because myself and Rachel this morning were like going, no one likes to be shit at communication, or to say it was a personality thing, or that they just didn't work it out. And I'm like going, that's what you're in the game for. This is the game of personality and behavior change. And you're going to get it wrong because people are tough. But just at least admit to yourself that some patients you're going to win and sometimes you're going to lose. And the ones you lose, you need to reflect on and find a better way of speaking to them. And if you can't find a better way by self-development, go on a course and learn how to do it.
Here, thanks, Sean.
Can we dive into...
Sound like I just shouted at you. sorry, Frank.
That's good.
Can we chat about reflection a little bit more? Is there anything that you've sort of learned tips and tricks wise that you tell the students you supervise? Because I think at university, the sort of the frameworks, the Gibbs cycle, it gets thrown around a lot. And I think Lewis is really strong on this as well. But I don't think there is a best way to reflect. And I think everybody needs to do it differently. And I think there's a lot for saying you need to find your way to do it. But I think for a lot of students and new grads, and probably a lot of senior physios as well, it's a very hard skill to do. And everyone needs to find something, whether it's sort of talking up through with other people, actually writing a reflection, finding a different model, asking themselves different questions. But we need to find a way, I think, generally of doing it better, more frequently, and actually implementing what we're reflecting on.
Yeah, you know, it's a great point, and the problem, it's a classic, it depends, isn't it? Because everyone reflects differently, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's the responsibility of, if you were working with me, Brad, you came to me and you said, look, I've had this thing and here's my reflection. It's down to the person you're bringing the reflection to ask good questions, you know, ask challenging questions, because it's the same for patients. You need to build their trust and you need to connect the patients as quick as possible, because you're going to have to challenge their behavior and beliefs often, not always, but you will have to ask awkward questions like, why are you not doing these things? Or what are you afraid of? Why do you believe this? There's some questions you have to ask patients that take bravery. And the same with reflection as well. You need to be brave to kind of say, yeah, I'm really not good at this, and this is highlights this. So I think you need to, this is where, again, it's not for everyone and it depends on where you work and it might decide on where you work, but you need a supervisor or someone you can bounce that off and kind of go, I've done this reflection piece. Is this just me just blowing smoke up my own arse basically by just saying I've done a great job and I reflected on it? Or is it actually allowing me? I think one of the big things is, have you then gone away? It's a bit like what I say about doing a course. I always want people when they leave my course to say, go away, pick one thing from that, read a book, read a paper, and educate somebody else about that topic. And you have to do all of those things. Once you have to speak to somebody and educate them on a topic, that is far better. So reflection should be education. And so therefore you really understand the problem. So if you've come with a communication issue, you then have to look into that and then come back. And it's not just, I did this and then I did that. It's going to be like, I did this and now this is what I do. And this is now part of my practice. And I now can talk to two people, three people, four people in your department and educate them on why they should do it as well, or maybe suggest why they should do it. If you want to do reflection, that's a proper reflection. You know, just a sheet of paper, tick box, student-y type thing. And when I say it like that, is you've got so much stuff like that you have to just do and write and all that. And I think half of it's not valuable. I think you need to be able to then implement what you've said in a really solid, reflective way, not just write it down a piece of paper, stick it on your drive and for someone to look at.
Thank you very much. Then the last area really I wanted to speak on was just sort of around the NCORE conference and the the talk that you delivered a little bit more. I know we've touched on it in bits. Well, am I right in thinking that you sort of were involved heavily in the organization of the conference?
Yeah, it was, I'd go as far to say it was my idea. So which sounds really like a knob would say, but so basically what happened was, I call myself a knob. Brilliant. First time on a podcast, but there you go. So Elsa from Encore is a bit of a sad story, unfortunately, because she's left. And she was really forward thinking, herself and another couple of people. So unfortunately, the Encore education, because they were brilliant. And unfortunately, a lot of their management's gone now. So I don't know where they're still around and I still use them. But hopefully they'll rebuild with another management structure. But anyway, Elsa came to me. She's a very forward thinking manager and was like, I want to do a 50th celebration. What do you think is a good topic? And I was like, without doubt, I was like, well, we need to do rehab. We need to focus on rehab, MSK rehab, because just as listeners may know, like in the UK, as you guys know, it's the way you can progress now is FCP. Like that's where money is with regards to education. It's all about prescription, injections, master's courses, modules, frameworks. There's band aids that can supervise you. It's all about that because you're taking pressure off GPs, which is very the way you can get, like the NHS likes, where you can say, right, this is amount, this is how much you saved, this is what we can do. It's very clear when it comes to this is how much you've taken off GPs and this is how much money you would save. So all the in the NHS especially or in that area, there's lots of people who are like band six going, where are the opportunities? It's like, well, it's FCP. So they have to get into FCP. And there are a lot of them, especially the ones who I spoke to, were like, I don't really want to. That's not what I want to do. But there's no other progression anywhere else. Or it's very rare that you can get progression. And there's certainly nothing around rehab. So there's no rehab specialists that when you should have, in my opinion, you should be band eights who are going around and supervising band sevens who are also rehab supervising or specialists that just look into what we're doing when it comes to our programming, the dosage, communication around that, and really look, because what you normally get in supervision is diagnosis, and then did you refer on, or do you need to refer on to a specialist, or imaging. It's very rarely like, okay, so you pick those exercises. Can you just give me a bit of reasoning behind why you've done that? Like that doesn't happen, and I know for a fact because I've done it, been in the game for 20 years, and it doesn't have that kind of in depth. Supervision around rehab does not happen. So I was like going, well, why doesn't it happen? Because it's our fucking main treatment. You know what I mean? This is what we do. We rehabilitate people and we're going to get loads of money towards people in GP practices, bombing loads of people into physio to now departments full of band fives and inexperienced band sixes with no one around to help them or support them, or certainly not an awful lot. Now, I know in bigger hospitals there will be, in bigger cities, but in where I live in Cornwall, there's not very many people in the department. There might only be one person. So this band five's on there by themselves with no one, and they're just free to just crack on. And because the experienced physio is in a GP practice 15 miles away and only comes in maybe half a day a week. So my point was, is I was like going, I want to get rehab back on this. And I knew the people who I wanted to get involved, which was like Joe Gibson, Mike James, Mehmet Cem, and Andrew Jaggi, all incredible physios, all incredible, you know, teaching physios. And I wanted to start it as a journey. I wanted to go from, what do you do if you are an FCP? How do you set up a rehab journey? Because a lot of the patients you're dealing with go into physio, but how do you make sure you don't biomedical them and think, right, they're going to go there and they're going to get this and this? How do you set up that it's a positive experience? If you're going to mention arthritis, show it in a positive light with rehab. If you're going to measure, if you're going to say it's something like impingement, inverted commas, please don't use that terminology and use it something that people are going to think rehab's going to help. So your job, if you think it's a rehab, make sure you set them up in your communication from the FCP. And that's what Mehmet did. And then we looked at trying to say, right, well, then how do you identify your athletic and non-athletic population, which is my chat. And that's where I kind of came up with the metaphor of why everyone is Italian. And then it was Joe Gibson about the athletic population. Mike was the less non-athletic, and then finally Andrew was territory care, you know, complex Stanmore patients. So I kind of tried to look at it as a rehab journey. And you were there, obviously, Brad. So you can see it's hopefully it was looking at, we were all saying similar messages, no matter where we were at any stage of that, even right down to really complex psychological issues with Stanmore, and then just straight off the bat, someone coming in the door with FCP. So that was the concept, and it the feedback and everything was excellent. You know, I think people were really crying out for that.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it on the day, and I think the flow that you kind of went for really really shone through, and having those sort of similar messages transferred through different mediums in different sort of settings, different backgrounds, I think it really sort of solidified that this objective is the most important bit, and what you're aiming for, it can be a lot less, and it just kind of needs to be in your wording, how you present the ideas to the patient, rather than the best exercise, the best approach, the best whatever it is. But yeah, I think that really shone through. So that was really good. Frank, have you got
I think if anyone wants, if like, I think, I suppose what I'd want to, I think where you select, you where you work, I think, you know, as, if you're listening and you want to get a job, and it's same with you, Frank, you know, do your research and where you're going to go working. You know, I think I kind of did, I worked in the Royal London in London. I'd kind of done a placement there. So I kind of knew the quality that was there. And so I wasn't disappointed. But some people just grab jobs anywhere, you know, I'll just start a job there and there. Just do a bit of homework on it as well, I think probably would be a pointer. You know, don't just accept anywhere, because you want to have a place where there's good mentorship. Start off with good, you know, if you can, especially if you've done a placement somewhere and you think, you know, they're banging there. That's a good place to work. And then, you know, if a job comes up there, because I think that's the thing. I think we just, you know, just want to go somewhere and get a job, but do your research on it, because again, that makes a massive difference. That, you know, like I was surrounded by, like some of the physios I work with now are like leading owning clinic owners in London. Chris Myers, who like runs SMUG, which is the ultrasound training. You know, like a bunch of guys who've been incredibly successful. And that we were in this environment where you were pushed, you were asked to do presentations, your communication, like we were every 3 months on placements, you had to stand up in front of very experienced physios and present patients to them. And then they would grill you on it. So it was very, it was uncomfortable. It certainly wasn't the nicest thing to do, but looking back now, it really helped me kind of be critical and to look at, you know, presentations and how to communicate with people as well, you know. So make sure you do your research when you're going to get a job, I think.
Yeah. Considering the people that you surround yourself with, because
it is that, yeah
perfect. Frank, have you got any more questions or anything else you want to go into, or should we sort of move on to the quick fire?
No, I think that was a real good point there, just about your product or your environment. And maybe I like the way Andrew just phrased that of like reversing it. No way. I know a lot of students, like in my class, they say, oh, I'll just get a job there, or I'll just get a job there, whereas Andrew's kind of saying, well, no, think about like who you can get mentored by, because I know you said you went to that Royal in London, Andrew, and like
the Royal London, yeah,
that's a real good teaching college, and the environment there, as you say, maybe it was tough, but it stood to you long term. So yeah, that's definitely mentorship and environment, that'll probably be the points.
And look, if you get it that. Yeah, if you get it wrong, you know, you can move, like, you know what I mean? The thing is, don't get stuck in a rut as well. Like that, I have, it's probably actually going to be maybe a question you'll ask me in a minute, but yeah, it's just don't be afraid to kind of, you know, you're in control. So just do a bit of research on it and ask other physios or whoever else, where's a good place to go? Why, you know, just do a bit of that, knocking around, see what happens.
Yeah, I think it probably links into what Dalton said as well last week about sort of enjoying where you're working and kind of feeling like you fit in, even if it's hard and it's challenging. If you're having a good time and you're enjoying what you're doing, you're going to get more out of it. You're not going to feel as deflated at the end of the day. You're going to have a better experience. You're going to develop more. So if you're really not enjoying the place that you're working, or if you had a bad placement and you know that's not going to be a good environment for you, then yeah, really consider those things when you're looking at where you want to work and what area you want to go into. Perfect.
Yeah, don't be afraid to ask people. Don't be afraid. Like, you know, don't be afraid to. All people can say is, "Nah," or "I'm too busy," or "Don't reply to your email." That there's nothing wrong with asking people. Like, you know, sometimes people ask me, "Oh, can you come and sit in my clinic?" And I'm like, in private, there's just no way. I can't do it. So I'll be polite and I'll recommend something else. But if they want other things, if I've got time, I'll answer. You know, I'll always kind of go, right, well, I can recommend it. I've called people. People have called me. Then you'll find if you ask, and if someone's busy, ask somebody else. Like, I think that's another skill. You don't be afraid to. You've got to put yourself out there as well. You've got to look for opportunity. You know, there's a lot of passive stuff going on. You know, you guys are obviously all over this. You know, with the stuff you're doing, going out there asking questions, meeting people, all that kind of stuff. I think that's brilliant. I think it's the future of good therapists is that ability to go and think. Right, well, I'm standing still here. I need to do something. Challenge myself. Challenge my thinking. Where else am I going here? If I did that, and you don't always get rewarded straight away. And some of the things that have happened to me over my career was just me just speaking what I felt was the truth at the time. And one of those things was when a surgeon asked, a hip surgeon came and said to us as a department, you know, how are we gonna, you know, what can we do with these hips? You know, we've got problems with hips and getting them better and stuff. And I stood up, I said, because our rehab's crap and we need to get better at it. And I thought, like, you know, I was saying as we, I wasn't kind of saying I'm brilliant at it. I just said, yeah, no, I think we need to up it. And he was buzzing, but I got a bunch of slack from the physios about that. They did not like me saying that. And I was like, and he didn't mind. And he went, come and sit in my clinic. So from there, that led to sitting in his clinic every week, loads of conversations, good relationships. And now, like, as in private practice, we've got a great relationship. I've been to conferences with him. We've had, you know, his other colleagues as well, getting to know them, referrals into private practice. A trust is built with that. Just because I stood up and just went, look, don't think this is right. And even though people around me were like, yeah, you can't say that. We're doing our best. And I was like, oh, well, it's not fucking great though, is it? Because he's standing in front of us telling us it's not great. So I had to kind of say, no, you're right. Let's do something about it. We developed FAI programs and looked at how we could speed things up with that. And that came out of nothing. I was a band six, just, you know, not that that was, you know, I don't like whatever band you are, but it was just more like, right, where's the opportunity here? So you just never know. Always look for them. Don't just sit there and think it's going to happen.
Just another quick note about Neonic. If you are in the Bradford or Shipley area and would like to get some help with an injury or long-term condition and private physiotherapy is simply just not affordable for you, then Neonic may have the solution. Offering a free initial appointment and your subsequent 5 follow-up appointments only costing £20 total, Neonic offer an extremely affordable physiotherapy service. Don't worry, the price does not reflect the quality of care you will receive. The students are supervised by expert physiotherapy practitioners that have a wealth of experience from a range of different backgrounds. If you would like to find out more about the services Neonic offer, whether that's from a student or patient perspective, you can find out more at neonic.co.uk, and we'll leave the link in the show notes.
Should we jump into these quick fire questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see, Andre, quick fire question, 3 most important qualities of a good physio.
3 most, yeah. The number one is, and I'll give you a book for every one of these.
Great.
So that would be the one. Grit, and I won't rant. Grit is the first one because it's the name of a book. Grit's by Angela Duckworth. She's a Stanford University psychologist. Great book to read. So, and it's what I just said. You need, you know, what she discovered in her research, and she's done a lot of this across sport, finance, the military, is that people who score high on a grit scale, and you can get the scale off the internet and do it, they're more successful than anyone with all the talent. You need to keep going. It needs to be uncomfortable. You need to be all right with that. And you need to, as I used to say about ultramarathon runners, you need to run, puke, eat the puke, and carry on. You need to be able to do that. To be an ultra marathon runner, you have to be a little bit mental. So, and with being a good physio, you need to, you know, you're going to hit bumps. You're going to do that. You just got to keep challenging yourself and moving on. The second one, the other book with, so her book is called Grit. And then Carol Dweck, who would have been also a Stanford University, is called Mindset. So those two together would be why you should have grit. The second one would be curious, but not arrogant. So be curious about questions. And what I mean by that is, like, as a student, you don't want some mouthy student going, well, I read a paper last night and da 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 da. So you got to work on your communication, not be a dick, basically. So, but you can be curious in a way that's kind of like, you know, wonder why that is. And I think that's a good model for being a therapist. Just, you know, research is tricky as it is. It's difficult to do. It's difficult to do in our area. So just be, you know, be respectful when it comes to questioning. There's definitely a shift towards, and I'm definitely like people challenging. A lot of my mates are involved in that kind of like challenging practice at the moment. And everyone has their way of doing that. But my way is not to kind of just start hammering people. My way is to kind of just be kind of like, you know what? There's going to be some people you can change their mind, and then there's other people who just don't. And there's no point banging your head off that. I'm just going to try and create something over here. And if you want to come and join me, come and join me. I'm not going to spend my time shouting at people that are blatantly just don't want to hear that. I just can't deal with that. So being curious and ask questions, but don't be a dick. And then the last one is kind of coming on from that, which is just be sound and develop a growth mindset. So just be sound to people in wherever you're asking a physio to mentor you, or will you go on a podcast, or patience. Start with that kind of just being like you would be when you're trying to meet a friend. You're just going to be sound to start with, and then build from there. I think those three things, you won't go far wrong. And if you want a book for Be Sound, just Chimp Paradox is a good book for that.
Oh, sure. What excites you the most about the future of physiotherapy?
What excites me about the future? Stuff like this, lads. The fact that G boys are out there, and girls obviously as well, but you specifically this kind of stuff where people are trying to push positive education. I think that show, and I've seen the younger physios coming on, or the less experienced coming on my course, I can see them like they're a different breed. And it's a growth mindset that I'm really excited about, because I think that's the future. And I think if we keep encouraging that and keep encouraging these conversations, and I like the name of your podcast, Talking Physio, it's good. So I like that idea. It's a communication and name as well. I think the untapped kind of stuff that we've been talking about, coaching and communication, we're miles behind marketing, branding, retail in communication, like miles behind. Those guys know human beings inside out. Like they we buy shit we don't need. Like I've got about 50 pairs of trainers. I've got a stupid amount of hoodies. I've got about 10 pairs of jeans. I don't need all that shit, but marketing companies have done a right job on me. You know, we buy stuff all that. They're unbelievable at understanding, influencing behavior. And we are miles behind on that. So there's an untapped resource of getting better at that, helping people get into where they want to be while we manage their mental health at the same time. Because there's also just so much out there. There's so much overwhelm. There's so much choice that us as therapists can often help them go, you know what, let's zip this right down into a really small, nice bundle. And this can make your life much easier. And you can often see patients going, oh, great. I thought I needed to do all this stuff. Just keep it nice and tight. Keep it nice and simple. So that untapped coaching, communication, influence, behavior change is you could just keep going with it. It's something that we could really work on. There's only so much you can learn about the knee anatomy and what will happen with that, and so many exercises about the knee. But with coaching, it's never ending. And I guess from that, then finally into that, is the tech that's available now comparing to like even 5 or 10 years ago. So like force detection, measuring strength, measuring force, measuring power, measuring bloods. I've just been given a VO2 max estimation machine by SessioFit. And basically, it's I place a very small device on your chest, which is stuck. It's got a little sticky pad. And I then have the app communicates with it, and I get an estimation of your VO2 max in 40 seconds. which is within the confidence intervals are really impressive. It's less than 10. So like the significance of the algorithm that they use is really, really accurate. And it saves you having to jump on a fucking bike for 30 minutes and nearly kill yourself, you know? But like obviously it's not for the athletes and testing VO2 max. That's a bit more accurate. But this is really, you know, this is within a very close range. And this is, you just lie people down. So like, I'm like, I can tell your VO2 max like that. I've got force plates here and dynamometers that measure rate of force development and give me lovely graphs and stuff that's really useful for guiding my rehab. So I'm really excited about that kind of tech coming out. And there's more and more stuff coming out. And I think moving away from the old pain stuff, like I'm going to stick this vibrating thing on you and that's going to hopefully change your pain. Like if it does, happy days. But I want stuff that's going to help me as a therapist communicate better and actually give me results that I can then adapt my rehab for that patient. So I give them what they wanted when they said at the very beginning. And that's going to give them a buzz, me a buzz. And then hopefully also, if you're in private practice, generate more referrals because people are going, that's the guy who got me what I wanted and he's sound. Going back to being a sound therapist, you know?
Yeah. Perfect.
And then final question. Are you satisfied? Are you happy with that you did the physio, that you didn't go down the sports science route or down a different route?
So, you know, it's like the old high performance question, you know, are you happy at the end? And everyone goes, yeah. Satisfied is a good question, lads. I like that one. Are you satisfied? Because it's a double-edged sword. I am definitely satisfied that I couldn't do anything else. You know, it's one of those ones. Like I tried to be a footballer and I looking back now, I'm thinking it just wouldn't have suited me anyway. And I'm like going, so yeah, I think I'm lucky I've selected this job, I guess, but I'm pretty good at following my gut and knowing what was right. So yes, I'm satisfied. But in this, at the same point, which is the double-edged sword, is I'm never satisfied that I can't be like content with what I'm doing. I'm you know, I think it's a probably disease of most people who are like, want to achieve or want to progress, and I get excited by that. So I've got stuff that's going to be coming out this year, that I, you know, which will include a podcast to rival your podcast. No, it won't be at that. We're going to podcast out, but yeah, so stuff like that excites me. But it's you know, it can wear you out a bit because you hear about like footballers and they're like, you know, you win a trophy and then it's just on to the next trophy. And I feel a little bit like that, you know, you get that kind of feeling of, you know, when do you get contentment? And I suppose I probably battle with that a little bit. But I think the key thing for me is as a therapist, I suppose I would give is if I feel kind of comfortable, I know I need to challenge myself or move on a little bit. I need to be satisfied and need to say, oh, yeah, I've done a good job there. But then I need to be like, I need to step it up. What's the next thing that's going to give me purpose and meaning? Because I think that makes me really buzz at the end of the day, even if it is tricky or difficult. I think if I don't have that, I struggle.
Yeah, I think that speaks a lot to who you are, Andrew. But I think there's a lot to be said for being able to live in the present and not always keep looking to the future. Actually enjoy the journey while you're on it and reflect back and be proud of how far you've come as well, not just always looking to want to do more and more and more.
You sound like my dad because have you read Eckhart Tolle's Power of Now?
My
dad is, I think he's given away 20 books. I know that was your last question, but it's called The Power of Now. So I have read more mindfulness now books. So when you said that, I was like, I know. It's an important skill, and that's why when you ask me the question, I'm like going, most people, yeah, but I'm like, no, it is something that, yeah, it's a curse in some ways, and you're absolutely right. But that book, The Power of Now, is something you go back to it and then you read it thinking, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and you do need to celebrate what you've done. But yeah, I don't know, my chimp inside my brain doesn't agree with you. My logical brain totally agrees with you, but chimp is gone. I can do more, man. Yeah. That's the balance in it.
You're starting to levitate as you say that there, Andrew. You're getting all saying.
I'm just like going, yeah. Bro, yeah. God, the shit talking has got it's increased. Sorry, I didn't ask you if I could swear in your podcast, lads. I've absolutely destroyed your hopefully yes. No young children were listening to during this.
Well, yeah, we'll have to leave a disclaimer.
You'll have to leave. I'm afraid so. It usually comes with my interviews, I'm afraid. Sorry about that.
That's perfect. Well, thank you very, very much, Andrew. I feel like we could be here all night if we didn't have other things to do.
Yeah, so
but no, I think we've probably got enough content to do a couple of these, so maybe again in the future. But yeah, thank you for everything today.
Best of luck, lads. You're doing a great job.
Perfect.
Sound.
So thank you for listening to episode 33 of the Talking Physio podcast. As usual, we'll leave the description and all of Andrew's several book recommendations in the description. Thank you, and bye for now.